Hello, everyone. I am Rachel Telfor.
And I'm Michelle Gower.
We are the hosts of a new true crime podcast.
It is called Children of the Void.
The Void refers to children who are missing.
And children who have died under mysterious and suspicious circumstances.
Sometimes parents know nothing about what has happened to their child.
And sometimes they seem to know more than they let on.
Like Casey Anthony.
And the JonBenet Ramsey case.
We are determined to do our part to find missing children.
And the truth when the story of their disappearance doesn't hold up.
Together, we will blast the shadows with light so that no more children disappear into the void.
Children of the Void debuts in September.
Join us so we can all make a difference.
Please subscribe.
Until then, I'm Rachel Telfor.
And I'm Michelle Gower.
You can catch Children of the Void on Apple, Spotify, YouTube,
and everywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hey y'all, Morgan Rector here. Do you have an idea for a podcast? Furthermore, would you like to host and co-produce your own podcast? I am always looking to expand the portfolio of my company, Leader One Podcast Network. If you'd like to have your own show, send me an email and we can talk about it. Aside from politics and religion, I'm open to just about any topic. If you are passionate, knowledgeable, and articulate, I want to talk to you. You can contact me by email, morgansvariety@gmail.com. I hope to hear from you soon. Hey, Morgan Rector here. I'm just dropping a line to say thank you to all of my Patreon donors. Since I'm not a Joe Rogan or Mark Maron, podcasting is more or less a starving artist gig for guys like me. Patreon donations keep me from having to take a job that would take away from my ability to generate more Human Monsters content. The website URL for Patreon is www.patreon, that's spelled patreon.com/leader. O-N-E, Leader One. A way to make a one-time donation is to send it through PayPal at morganrector331, Rector spelled R-E-C-T-O-R, at hotmail.com, morganrector331@hotmail.com. You don't have to give a large amount of money if it isn't possible. If $1 a month or $1 one time is the best you can pony up, it would be gratefully accepted. I know how hard things are for everybody during COVID. Thank you for all the support you have given the show, whether it is through financial donations or simply by listening. I am grateful for all you have given to me and the program. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Human Monsters. Part 1. The Baby Farmers. Being a single mother has never been easy. In the 19th century, the hardships exceeded the strains of financial privation. To conceive, bear, and give birth to a child out of wedlock was heavily stigmatized. There were no legal consequences, but within the social stratum, the repercussions were severe. With no legal protections, single mothers were thrown out of their homes, fired from their place of employment, and left to fend for themselves and their child in a world that condemned them as a Jezebel with no moral compass. To compound the misfortune of single mothers in Great Britain, Parliament passed the 1834 Poor Law Amendment Act. This legislation absolved the fathers of responsibility for children born outside of wedlock. Like the Greek god Atlas, it was incumbent upon the single mother to bear responsibility for her one-parent family alone. After being cast out by society, shunned by their families, and denied employment, it was a difficult weight to bear all by oneself. Domestic servants were among the most vulnerable to falling into this situation. They were often sexually exploited by a member of the family they worked for. Even if the child were conceived through rape, she would be terminated from her position. This meant that not only did she have no income, but also no place to live. Abortion was both illegal and a risk to the mother's life, given the barbaric methods applied at the time. Fearing the dishonor of being exposed as a mother of a child conceived out of wedlock, many of these women would go as far as to murder the child. Whether through poisoning, strangling, or drowning, they felt the cost of keeping and caring for the child far outweighed the remorse that might keep them up at night after committing infanticide. In this case, the baby's birth would not be registered for fear of legal reprisals. One example was Jane Cox, who gave birth to an illegitimate child in May 1896. He was born alive, but as babies do, he cried. Cox was so terrified that her employer would hear the child that she beat his face before strangling him. Jane Cox was charged with infanticide, but was discharged shortly thereafter. It wasn't unusual for police officers and scavengers to find babies, dead or alive, in quiet, deserted locations, like rivers, canals, dimly lit streets, and alleyways. At that time, the most common offenses committed by women were concealment of a birth and infanticide. For infanticide, the sentence could be death. Concealment of a birth could incur sentence of 2 years in prison. There were no welfare agencies funded and facilitated by the government. There were a few charities that ran orphanages. Either they were poorly run, or they had such stringent specifications that it was nearly impossible to bring a child on board. Often out of desperation, a single mother who had the money to spare would place her child with a nurse known colloquially as a baby farmer. Typically female, they would foster a child for a fee. Their services were advertised in newspapers with a headline like, "Highly respectable married couple wish to adopt child." The transactions were processed through a series of letters. The handover would occur in a public place, like a railway station. Once this transaction took place, the child could be passed on to other baby farmers, with each woman taking her cut of the action. That or the baby would be sold to a childless couple. Because of this practice, and the use of aliases by the parties involved, it was difficult to impossible for the birth mother to track the adoption process, and they typically lost track of their children. The practice was unregulated, and there were no legal protections for the children or the parents. In today's parlance, this practice would be deemed human trafficking. Some baby farmers were caring and ethical, others not so much. Many of these children were neglected and, in some cases, left to starve and waste away to their death. The more pernicious practitioners of this trade were most keen on babies who were younger than 2 months. The reasoning was that since the child's fragile health would likely leave them vulnerable to an early demise, they could make a fast buck without being saddled with the burden of caring for a child in the long term. In 1868, an article about these women published in the Salford Weekly News characterized these people as, quote, "women of dissolute habits and without shame," end quote. Quite often the neglect was reflected in the child's diet, which was deficient in the amount of nutrition that would be required for an infant to thrive. They were fed watered-down milk, potatoes, bread, or a diluted gruel. Some were fed coarse sugar that was sucked through rags. Because their diets were devoid of nutrition, the babies were susceptible to illnesses like diarrhea, which was a common cause of death for infants at the time. Some of the baby farmers would give liquor or opiates to the child to suppress their appetite and keep them quiet. One mixture that was popular among baby farmers was Godfrey's cordial, which was opiate dominant. It was also known as the, quote, quietness and, quote unquote, the mother's friend. It was a blend of laudanum, syrup, and spices. Laudanum was a popular tranquilizer and pain reliever at the time, among all ages, and it was available at pharmacies over the counter. Then again, it was also sold in general stores. The sale and possession of it were illegal, but entrepreneurs found ways to sell it. Godfrey's cordial was dangerous to underfed babies. They would die of malnutrition because it suppressed their appetites when they were badly in need of essential nutrients. The babies would starve until they were skeletal. On paper, these deaths would be classified as being attributed to, quote-unquote, general debility or marasmus. Marasmus can affect anyone of any age, but children are especially vulnerable to this condition. It is frequently caused by malnutrition. Common symptoms include weight loss, stunted growth, dry skin and eyes, brittle hair, diarrhea, lower immunity, stomach infection and lactose intolerance, respiratory infections, rickets due to calcium and vitamin D deficiency, anemia due to iron deficiency, impaired brain function and intellectual disability, low blood pressure or hypotension, low body temperature or hypothermia, slow heart rate or bradycardia. There was a very high infant mortality rate in Victorian England, so these deaths were not detected by the authorities. In 1864, the Registrar General reported that about 2,300 children died before their first birthday from unspecified causes. Many others were undocumented. Feeling their children were avoiding this fate, single mothers would place their children with baby farmers, feeling they were giving them the gift of a better life. Part 2. Enter Amelia Dyer. Amelia Dyer was born Amelia Elizabeth Hobley in 1836 in the small village of Pyle Marsh. While growing up, she demonstrated an aptitude for language and not only learned to read and write, but was fond of literature and poetry. Sadly, this was not enough to ensure a happy childhood. Her mother contracted typhus, which resulted in mental illness. Her mother would become violent and hysterical. Amelia served as her caregiver until her death in 1848 from meningitis. One potentially seminal event in her youth was when an older cousin had a daughter out of wedlock. The child was raised by her grandparents. With this situation having become accepted and normalized within her family, Amelia was not as likely as the common Brit to find illegitimacy indigestible. Amelia married George Thomas, who was decades older than she, with him being 59 and her being 24. They lied about their ages on the marriage certificate, to reduce the age gap. Soon after, she began a career in nursing. Following a discussion with a midwife, Amelia was inspired to open a home to provide housing for young women who conceived illegitimately. That would be phase one of her services. She would also farm the babies off for adoption, or allow them to die of neglect and/or malnutrition. This was far more appealing to her than the long and exhausting hours she would have to invest as a nurse working the rounds in hospital. Amelia Dyer was in it for the money, plain and simple. Nurses were poorly compensated at the time, so she was eager to retire from this profession. She didn't miss it. She was working at a psychiatric hospital, which was uniquely stressful in its own right. When she embarked on her career as a baby farmer, she used several aliases to avoid prosecution. Among them, Stanfield, Harding, Thomas, Weymouth, Thornley, Waven, Smith. She presented herself to her clients as a married woman with no children and living in, quote-unquote, a nice country home. According to Lloyd's Weekly newspaper, her clients ranged, quote, from those in high places to the humble shopkeeper, end quote. Part 3, Investigation. Detective Constable Anderson investigated a parcel that had been entered into evidence for an investigation into a chain of infanticides. When he questioned a mail clerk, he was informed that though it was addressed to one Mrs. Thomas in Piggott's Road, the clerk was aware that the recipient's real name was Dyer. She lived at 45 Kensington Road, near Oxford Road. Anderson and Sergeant James went to the house to inquire about the parcel. They discovered that the suspect went to London. They spoke with one of her neighbors. She said she gave Mrs. Dyer some string for a parcel on Monday morning. It was the same day a dead child was found. The string the lady gave her was identical to the kind that was used to bind the body of the child that was recovered from the river. Chief Constable Tousley ordered James to place Dyer's house under surveillance. April 3rd. It was the day after Amelia Dyer's return from London. The police sent a woman posing as a decoy to Dyer's address. She was to inquire about fostering a child. There were no female officers at the time, so quite often the wives of policemen would carry out this task. She came to an agreement with Mrs. Dyer that she would return later that day with a baby and a fee of £50, which is roughly the equivalent of £5,000 today, or $5,664 2021 American dollars. The handover was scheduled for 3 p.m. Dyer was shocked when she opened her door at the agreed-upon time to find Detective Anderson and Sergeant James standing there. Having gone into shock, she wore her culpability on her face. She was placed under arrest. She was remanded in a city jail while investigators searched her house. Amelia Dyer did not live alone. There were 7 tenants in total. There was an elderly woman named Jane Smith, who was also known among the residents as Granny Smith. She helped with housework and child care. The children receiving that care were 11-year-old Nellie Oliver, 9-year-old Willie Thornton, and a 3-month-old baby. Dyer had a lodger named Mrs. Chandler. Chandler had 2 daughters living there. As the investigators searched, they found the following items of interest: a large quantity of baby clothes, 15 pawn tickets, several children's vaccination certificates, receipts from newspaper advertisements, tape of the same type that was wrapped around a dead child's neck, letters detailing the stories behind parents being forced to relinquish custody of their children, As they searched, the officers detected a foul odor throughout the house. Mrs. Chandler told them she had smelled it for some time and complained about it to Mrs. Dyer. Dyer denied its presence. When the police asked her about it, she said it came from musty old clothes. The police discovered a large tin box. It was locked, but they managed to open it. The smell had been coming from the box, though it was empty at the time. April 4th. Amelia Dyer appeared before the magistrate at Reading Police Court. She was charged with feloniously killing a child. The identity of the child was unknown at the time. Constable Tousley recounted his discovery of the drowned infant in the River Thames. As evidence, he presented the string lent to Mrs. Dyer to be used on the parcel, her alias on the package in her penmanship, the tape found at her house that was of the same manufacture as the kind that had been wrapped around the baby's neck. Tousley asked the magistrate for consent to complete their investigation at Dyer's home. Before authorizing this action, the magistrate asked Mrs. Dyer for her comments regarding the charge. She said, "I do not know anything about it. It's all a mystery to me." The police left no stone unturned in Dyer's home. They used birth certificates, vaccination documents, and letters to track down parents who gave their children to Dyer. The police discovered in one letter that Dyer's son-in-law, Arthur Ernest Palmer, may have been an accomplice. Palmer worked as a commission agent for a sewing machine manufacturer. When his home was searched, a stock of baby clothing so immense it outweighed his 18-month-old son's needs was found. Used cloth diapers and clothing were handed over. 10 pawnbroker's tickets for children's clothing and a bundle of linen found in the kitchen were deemed admissible into evidence. Palmer was arrested under suspicion of being an accessory to murder after the fact. Chief Tousley arranged for the Thames and Kennet Rivers to be dragged. That evening, a parcel of linen rags emerged under the Clapper's footbridge. When it reached the surface, it fell apart and a brick fell out. Laborer Henry Smithwaite lifted a baby's body from the remains of the package. The body had disintegrated to the point that the head broke off and floated down the river, out of reach. There were no marks on the child's body. A length of tape was tied securely around its neck. The coroner determined that the infant was just a few weeks old and had been submerged in the water for weeks. Not only was it missing a head, but the bone of one of the legs had broken from the torso. The bowel was protruding from its back. The pathologist was unable to prove that the strangulation by tape caused the child's death. He also could not determine if he was dead before he was tossed in the water or if he drowned. Another package was found in the river by a laborer. A coroner was able to fix the age of the child at 9 months based on his teeth, since 8 had been formed. Before the infant was dumped, he was bundled in layers of sacking and cloth. There were no indicators of physical abuse on his body, but 2 pieces of tape had been tied around his neck. A section of pocket handkerchief had been stuffed into his mouth. The body had decomposed to such a degree that the bones came apart. The abdominal cavity and chest erupted. Due to all this, Dr. Maurice could not conclude the exact cause of death. He was left with no alternative but to report that the baby was suffocated by the handkerchief and tape. April 10th. Henry Smithwaite and a man named Alfred George Botting dragged the river in the town of Caversham under the supervision of Sergeant James. A package was pulled up from a depth of 12 feet. When it emerged in the open air, They found it to be a carpet bag tied with string. The top was open a few inches. Some brown paper had been placed over the contents. James cut the string and opened the bag. It contained the corpse of a baby girl. He removed a brick that had been used to weigh it down. When it was brought to the police station, he discovered that a baby boy had been found under identical circumstances, only it had been weighed down with a smaller brick and a stock of baby linen. Both bodies were removed from their respective packages and documented photographically. Neither of the bodies bore scars indicative of physical abuse, but tape of identical manufacture was wrapped around both infants' necks and used as ligatures. The tape wrapped around the boy was 40 inches long and secured with a bow, as if it were some kind of gruesome benefaction for a depraved recipient. Dr. Maurice concluded that both children had been dead for 10 days. Strangulation was proven to be the cause of the boy's departure, and likely the same for the girl. Both infants had otherwise been in good health. There were indicators that they were well nourished and would have thrived under ideal circumstances. The girl had even received 4 vaccinations. April 11th. Amelia Dyer and Arthur Ernest Palmer were brought before a full bench of magistrates at Reading Police Court. The case had received a great deal of attention, and a large crowd assembled outside, though only a small minority of those present were admitted to the courtroom. Palmer entered the dock first. Though he was elegantly attired, he was otherwise nervous and haggard. Amelia Dyer entered next. She was unaware that Arthur had been arrested. She turned to a court official and said, "What's Arthur here for? He's done nothing." The proceedings began with Dyer receiving another charge for the murder of an unknown female child, this one having been found in the Thames River on March 30th. Palmer was charged as an accessory after the fact. The prosecutor, Sidney Brain, requested an adjournment so the police would have more time to complete their investigation. More bodies were being recovered, with no end in sight. The chairman of the bench asked Amelia Dyer if she objected to an extension of her remand. She said, "I don't know." When the same question was posed to Palmer, he said, "I am not guilty." Both prisoners were remanded for another week. That same day, 2 women arrived in Reading to identify the babies found in the carpet bag. Evelina Marmon identified the body of her baby daughter, Doris. Distraught and unable to restrain herself, she cried out, "She was in perfect health when I sent her away." She also recognized her child's clothing among garments found at Arthur Palmer's address. Amelia Hannah Sargent identified the boy as being Harry Simmons. She cared for him on behalf of his birth mother. Under questioning, Evelina said that on March 31st, she met with one Mrs. Harding at Gloucester Railway Station, where she paid her £10 to take care of her until the day of her adoption. When Doris was recovered from the Thames, she was covered in the same fawn-colored cloak Evelina wrapped her in when she surrendered her to Mrs. Harding. Mrs. Harding wrote her a letter informing her that she and Doris arrived in Reading safe and sound. That was the final link in the chain of correspondence. Amelia Sargent elected to take care of Harry Simmons after his father died and his mother abandoned him. However, she already had a large family, and money was tight, and with so many mouths to feed, it was not financially feasible to provide the care to which Harry was entitled. She decided that the best option was to put him up for adoption. She responded to an ad in the Weekly Dispatch placed by Amelia Dyer. It guaranteed adoption for a fee of £10. Applications were instructed to contact one Mrs. Harding at the Ship's Letter Exchange, Stokescraft, Bristol. Sargent explained to the court that the woman who initially identified as Anne Harding disclosed that her real name was Mrs. Thomas. The use of aliases was common among baby farmers. Sargent was persuaded of the necessity of this practice, so she didn't see it as sketchy. Having been assured that Harry would be in good hands once placed in the care of Mrs. Thomas, the transaction was arranged. It transpired at Paddington Station. Mrs. Thomas was accompanied by a young woman who was introduced as her quote-unquote niece. The girl held a toddler that looked unwell. Sargent gave Mrs. Thomas Harry as well as half of the 10-pound fee, which she vowed she would pay her later. She said he wore the same outfit when his body was recovered that he was wearing when she handed him over. Amelia Dyer was able to conceal her baby farming because she changed her address on a regular basis. Living at different houses, using different names, made it difficult for police and former clients to track her down. The trajectory of her fortunes went into decline on August 20, 1879. It was on that day that an inquest was opened in Bristol to investigate the deaths of two infants who died whilst in the custody of Dyer. Four babies in total died in her care around that time, two from atrophy and convulsions. After one baby was buried, she immediately tried to register the death of another child. This struck the attendant physician as suspicious, and he addressed his concerns to the coroner. The children died at Dyer's house when she was living in Totterdown. 6-week-old Elizabeth Thomas and 8-month-old Eveline Townsend were placed in Dyer's care by their parents. Both children were suffering from diarrhea when they died. Before they perished, they, along with several other babies, were passed along to foster mothers who were paid 5 shillings a week to take care of the children. At about this time, all the children living in Amelia Dyer's home were stricken with diarrhea. Local surgeon Dr. Alexander Carr informed the inquest that he treated one of the children, Alfred Channing, for diarrhea. He not only mentioned that it was common among Dyer's charges, but that the neglectful upkeep of the drains in Dyer's house was more than likely the cause of the condition of the children. The coroner was not able to prove this hypothesis, so he concluded that the babies died of natural causes. Dyer had been making a lot of money in the baby farming trade. She took on 6 children at a time at one point. One family paid her £100 to care for their child. Dyer was investigated for registering a birth under fraudulent circumstances. She was to be investigated by the Registrar General. 3 days later, the coroner conducted an inquest into the death of May Walters. She was the third of the 4 children who died whilst in Dyer's care. The name on her death certificate was registered as Annie May Walters Dyer. This led to suspicions regarding her identity and cause of death. May Walters died during surgery performed by one Dr. Milne on August 17th. This brought the number of deaths with connections to Amelia Dyer to 5. Milne told the inquest that he saw May 2 days earlier in the presence of Dyer. Dyer had adopted the role of foster mother. Dyer later claimed to him that the child was in recovery. Either she was deceptive or mistaken, for May died of convulsions and an intestinal disorder. After Milne signed the death certificate, he received a letter from local police officer Sergeant Dewey. He had questions about the child's identity. May's body was examined on a table in the parlor of Dyer's house. The first witness at the inquest was a woman named Jane Williams. She had not only known Dyer, but had lived with her. She didn't know May's real identity, but had seen her about a month before the inquest. Dyer asked her to take the child to a nurse because she already had 6 children in her care. Williams recalled that May was thin and underweight for her age. Her skin was marked by sores and a rash. She took May and a child named Bessie into her care. Though the children slept soundly through the night, Williams found it unnatural, since their breathing was noticeably labored. She mentioned that Dyer administered Godfrey's cordial to the children. Williams refused to do the same. Dyer instructed her to feed the babies a combination of boiled bread, corn flour, and condensed milk. The babies did not eat much, usually refusing it. When Williams returned May to Dyer, May had diarrhea. She had become so underweight, she was nearly skeletal. May's care was farmed out to a woman named Elizabeth Hacker. She said that when she received May, she was exceedingly dirty. Her diaper had not been changed in 2 or 3 days, even with the onset of diarrhea. As May's condition grew worse, Dyer asked Hacker to bring her back to her house. She specifically requested that she do so after dark, so that her neighbors would not be able to keep count of how many children she had. Dyer asked her to take May to Dr. Milne's surgery and pretend to be her sister, but Hacker refused. The next time Mrs. Hacker paid a visit to May at Dyer's house, later that week, May was tucked up in bed with an empty feeding tube stuck in her mouth. Though she was conscious, she was unaware of her surroundings and unresponsive. The last time she saw her at Dyer's parlor, May was swaddled in a blanket, but she was dead. She was on display, like a doll in a morbid merchandise display in a toy store straight out of the commercial thoroughfares of hell. The coroner at the trial summed up the case as being the worst that had ever been brought to his attention. Because of her inability to care for the children properly, she had, quote, hurried them to the grave, end quote. He characterized her place of business as, quote unquote, an infant's hell, and baby farming, quote unquote, in its worst and most vile aspect. The problem was, there was no evidence that the child was murdered directly by the hand of Amelia Dyer. The coroner could only recommend a charge of falsification of information within the death register. The jury deliberated for about 20 minutes, after which they returned a verdict of death by natural causes. Amelia was off the hook, but not for long. The same month, on August 29th, she was convicted of breaching the 1872 Infant Life Protection Act at Long Ashton Petty Sessions in Somerset. She received the maximum penalty for this transgression, which was 6 months imprisonment with hard labor. She was released in February 1880. She did not see the error of her ways. She was only determined to avoid detection and prosecution the next time around. A quote from the April 18th, 1895 issue of the Berkshire Chronicle. Her trade in children seems to have been pretty extensive. When the woman could give no satisfactory account of their whereabouts, she would sham madness. 1891. The Dyer family had moved to Stapleton. According to local newspapers, Amelia and her husband separated during this time, and he left their home. Amelia wasn't the only member of their family with a record of malfeasance. About this time, her 18-year-old daughter Mary stole a piano. She accomplished this by falsifying records. Amelia Dyer agreed to farm a baby for a well-to-do family whose latest addition was conceived illegitimately through an illicit affair. They sought Amelia Dyer to deal with the situation, hoping that by handing the child over to her, they could avoid the stigma. They came to regret this action and sought to reclaim custody of the child. Dyer told them she had subcontracted custody to other women. After the family pursued leads regarding the location of the child, they were unable to track it down. they finally decided to bring it to the attention of the authorities. In October 1891, they showed up at Dyer's doorstep with a police officer. Facing more legal consequence, Dyer went into a panic. She tried to commit suicide by cutting her own throat, but she lost her nerve, only leaving a scratch after three attempts. Mentally unstable and violent, Dyer was committed to the Gloucester County Asylum on November 13, 1981. She was discharged on January 12, 1892. She was deemed, quote-unquote, recovered. She returned to the baby farming business immediately upon release. The staff of the asylum were mistaken in diagnosing Dyer as recovered. Shortly before Christmas in 1893, the couple came back again looking for their lost child. This threw Dyer's mental health into further decline. Mary Ann Dyer called in one Dr. Frederick Logan. He examined Dyer on Christmas Eve. He observed that she was experiencing delusions, which led to violent behavior. While Logan was still on the premises, Dyer got up from her chair, ran to the fireplace, and grabbed a poker. She ran at Logan and threatened to break his skull. She made a go of it, but he managed to wrestle the poker from her grasp. He convinced her to sit down. Having become a little calmer, Dyer told him she had been hearing voices that told her to destroy herself. As she put it, the birds said, "Do it. Do it." Marianne told Dr. Logan about Amelia's suicide attempt. Logan concluded that Dyer was not of sound mind. To quote Logan, "She was wild and excitable. I was satisfied that she was a fit and proper subject for an asylum." Dyer was committed to the Somerset County Asylum in Wells on Boxing Day. She stayed there until January 20th. Amelia Dyer's mental health was stable until April 1894, when the parents of the unrecovered child returned once again to see if there was any word of where the baby might be. Following this visit, Dyer attempted to drown herself by leaping into a brook in Ashton Park. She was rescued. She was brought to hospital for treatment. She was in a deep depression, but was otherwise seen as fit for discharge. When Dyer returned home, she continued her work in the baby farming enterprise. Things were calm around the house until December 1894, when the governess and her husband, the couple whose inquiries about their missing child had caused Dyer to break down, came by one final time. This was when Dyer was living in a town called Fish Ponds. Four children were staying with her, two of whom were acquired through advertisements. Another child was born in the house. The first two brought in a profit of £30 and £40, respectively. The third brought in £80. Whenever a doctor visited the house, it never ended well. And sure enough, on December 14th, Dr. William Eden paid a visit. Dyer was highly volatile. She threatened to physically throw him out. She rambled, and he did not see any worth in interrupting her. She said God had forsaken her, and the world had hatched a conspiracy to bring her down. After 10 minutes of this, Dr. Eden signed a certificate to have Dyer committed to an asylum. She was admitted for the second time to Gloucester County Asylum on December 15th. The four nurse children were placed in a workhouse. The third child died in the workhouse, while the fourth was sent to Canada, where they reportedly found a better life. Dyer was discharged from the asylum on February 13th. She was transferred to another institution, the Barton Regis Workhouse. The Palmers had deserted her. She was in and out of the workhouse before being discharged. She lived in Cardiff for a time. Her life was generally chaotic as she restored her mental stability. She was together enough to adopt a 9-month-old baby from a young woman in Bristol for a fee of £10, however. Dyer moved out of Cardiff, and after a fortnight, The partial decomposed remains of an infant were found in the River Severn. Tried as they did, the police did not have sufficient evidence to link the infanticide to Amelia Dyer. When they searched her house in fish ponds, they found 30 telegrams in a stack of letters concerning the adoption of babies. They spoke to her neighbors, who speculated that about 6 children had been brought to her house for temporary care. Inspector Robertson of the Bristol Constabulary issued a warrant for the arrest of the woman known as Annie Smith. Bertie Palmer was dispatched to Barton Regis Workhouse. These marked the last days that Amelia Dyer would ever spend in Bristol. During her time there, several children went missing and dead babies were found. Police could not collect enough evidence to confirm her as the perpetrator, however. You don't hear the shot that kills you, and she was now wise to how the police had exploited the blind spots of which she had failed to remain cognizant. She was craftier now. Her time in Conn College freed her up to conceive of new ways to conceal her identity and criminal activity, and she was effective. She found better ways to commit infanticide to make a profit, while operating beyond the periphery of everything the probing eye of the law was equipped to perceive. The bodies and the money were piling up. For the time being, Amelia Dyer was winning. Dyer's daughter and her husband moved into Amelia's home in Cardiff after they were wedded. They maintained this arrangement for 6 weeks. During that time, they adopted 3 babies. One died of diarrhea and convulsions. The attendant physician said that the baby did not receive enough care. The child's death was not investigated by police. By the end of August 1895, the family were in dire straits financially. They were deeply in debt and were forced to leave Wales. They moved to Caversham, Oxfordshire. It wasn't long after they settled that the decomposing bodies of infants began to emerge in the River Thames. Before Amelia and her family could move into their new house in Caversham, the landlord caught wind of her unsavory reputation and refused to receive her furniture. Dyer and her family were now in the unenviable position of finding a landlord devoid of scruples. They moved into a house at 6 Elm Villas. After they got settled, Amelia went to work, commuting to London to take 9-year-old Willie Thornton into her custody. This was after she placed an advertisement in the newspaper. Her daughter and son-in-law were also involved, adopting 14-month-old Harold, whose surname would remain unknown. The authorities could never track down his parents. After a couple of months, the family moved again, this time to 26 Pigott's Road, located conveniently, and perhaps not coincidentally, along a riverbank. There were an estimated 5 children on the premises: Willie, baby Harold, a 2-year-old girl, and 2 babies. Dyer took the little girl to London and returned without her. It was presumed that she sold her. One of the babies was just 2 months old and was adopted by the Palmers. She was a nurse child from Swindon and was received at Reading Railway Station for a fee of £10. She died on October 20th, 1895. She was buried with the name Ina Clara Palmer. Arthur and Marianne were indicated as her parents on the death certificate. Marasmus was cited as the cause of death. Dyer's neighbors did not suspect that anything untoward was happening, despite the high turnover of children in her care. One odd item of note, however, was that, quote, "the bassinet was frequently left outside in the rain," end quote. Dyer did not befriend her neighbors and was generally deceptive about her name and background. After falling out with her daughter, the Palmers moved out. Dyer, Granny, and Willie Thornton moved to a new house in Reading on Kensington Road. The chief attendance officer of the local school board, George Phipps, noticed Willie playing on the street while school was in session. It was legally mandated that all children in Great Britain must be enrolled in school if they were between the age of 5 and 13. Phipps paid a visit to Dyer. Initially reluctant to enroll Willie in school, saying his mother was due to arrive and reclaim custody of him, she ultimately decided that providing this normal necessity of life to the boy would prevent anybody from becoming suspicious. Willie began classes at Battle Board School. Dyer told Phipps that Willie was the only child in the house. Among the findings he documented were that he did not observe the presence of other children in the house. More children were brought into Amelia Dyer's slaughterhouse. NSPCC officer Charles Bennett paid a visit after his wife became acquainted with Granny Smith. She told her about the nurse children. Aside from Willie Thornton, Bennett saw a 6-month-old baby. He was informed that she was the daughter of one Miss Nielsen, a domestic servant at an Anglo-French college in Eastbourne. The Berkshire Chronicle covered this detail and noted that the baby appeared to be well-nourished and receiving appropriate care. Bennett reminded Dyer that by law, she was required to register this activity with the local authorities. This was required of anybody who had 2 nurse children under the age of 12 months in their house. He knew something was off about the woman, who identified as Mrs. Thomas. When he asked her about her name, she told him her real name was Dyer, but she changed it because her husband was abusive, and she did not want him to find her. She said that on occasion she would use her mother's maiden name, which was Weymouth. At the end of January, Dyer adopted 11-year-old Ellen Maud Oliver, known as Nellie. Her mother was a domestic servant. Nellie had been placed with many different baby farmers throughout the years. Dyer collected her at a rail station and received £10 as compensation. Dyer had 2 babies in her care. January 12, 1896. Under the alias A. Stansfield, Amelia Dyer replied to an ad stating that a child was being put up for adoption. Dyer claimed to be a farmer's wife who had no children of her own. She assured the mother that the child would be raised well, that she would be loved, and be influenced by the Church of England. She said she would never accept money for such a transaction, but was in need of funds to help with the expenses. March 30, 1896. A bargeman spotted a parcel floating on the River Thames. Aware that the police were still searching the rivers for dead babies, he brought the package to the attention of the police. The address written on the package led them to Dyer. She was arrested on April 3rd. Bricks, string, tape, and cloth diapers were recognized as having been used by Amelia Dyer. There was another article of damning evidence, the agreement Miss Marmon signed, ensuring the transference of her baby's care to Dyer, using the alias Harding at the time. It came with a receipt for the £10 she paid. An advertisement in the Weekly Dispatch for a mother seeking adoptive parents was also located in Dyer's home. Another important clue was that Dyer was observed carrying a carpet bag on March 30th, whose cargo was so heavy she had to stop and rest several times. Willie Thornton was questioned by police. Among the various commercial activities he witnessed in connection with the baby farming, he noted that he recalled a baby that was adopted by Marianne Palmer and died at 26 Pigott's Road, and that he had seen her corpse. The memory that caused him the most distress concerned the stench that permeated the house. He said it originated from a locked box Dyer kept in her bedroom. He was keen to discover the source of the odor. At some point, he looked in a kitchen cupboard and saw a brown paper parcel, measurable at about a foot. The ends of the paper were tucked in. He saw it again at tea time. It had been covered with clothing. After that, it disappeared. Evidence gathering had been successful enough to lock down Amelia Dyer as a suspect in the infanticides. She was remanded to prison. Preparations were being made for her trial. Whilst in custody at Reading Prison, Amelia Dyer was on suicide watch since she tried to hang herself by her bootlaces at the police station holding cell. At Reading, her behavior was erratic and strange. She refused to eat. She requested a care package from Granny Smith, including books and sewing supplies. Granny Smith wasn't as loyal to Dyer as Amelia believed. Granny was interviewed by Jane Smith, a reporter for the Berkshire Chronicle. According to the article, Smith was critical of the way Dyer treated the babies, saying she was abusive. To quote Smith, "She was very cruel to them. She used to shake the little baby in a shocking manner." Smith said that it appeared that Amelia held her cats in higher esteem than the children she took care of. They even ate better. She said that when she visited Dyer in prison, she had the countenance of a maniac. Dyer wrote a letter to Chief Constable George Tousley. She requested that he pass on information to the magistrate at the next hearing. That information consisted of denials that the Palmers were involved in any way in the baby farming operation. She wanted them to be exonerated. April 18th. A hearing took place at the Reading Police Court. The key witnesses, Evelina Edith Marmon and Amelia Sargent, were brought to the police station yard to formally identify Amelia Dyer. Miss Marmon was highly distressed and burst into tears at the very sight of Dyer. She said, "That's the dreadful woman to whom I handed my Doris." Mrs. Sargent pointed her umbrella in Dyer's direction and said, "That's the vile creature who had the little fellow." The Reading police decided to return to the location near Clapper's Pool where the first few babies were found. On April 23rd, laborer Henry Smithwaite found a parcel close to the weir within the vicinity of Caversham. He stumbled upon it only 2 or 3 yards away from where he found the carpet bag that contained the corpses of Doris Marmon and Harry Simmons. The new package was wrapped in canvas and tied with a section of clothesline. Detective Constable Anderson went to the scene. When he opened the parcel, he discovered that yet another baby had been fished out of the water. He took the body to the police mortuary. Dr. Maurice determined that the corpse was of a 12-month-old female child. This body was in a more advanced state of decomposition than any of the others. Indeed, when the parcel was opened, the head fell apart. A length of tape was wrapped around her neck twice. A handkerchief had been stuffed into her mouth. Dr. Maurice was unable to discern the exact time of death. The body had deteriorated to such a degree that it negated the possibility of doing so. He opined that she had been submerged in the water between 4 and 6 months. There were signs that she had been strangled. A brick was attached to the parcel to weigh it down. Granny Smith was called to testify. After going into details about the dubious adoptions Dyer was involved in, she retold another tale of abuse. Identified as Baby Isaacs, the child was cutting teeth and had become temperamental as a result. Dyer once struck the baby on her ear to make her stop crying. Dr. Maurice found 9 teeth in her parcel to match the ones that were still embedded in her jaw. After hearing testimonies and examining evidence, the final verdict in both cases brought against Amelia Dyer was willful murder against Mrs. Dyer. Arthur Palmer was charged with being an accessory after the fact when his involvement in the baby farming transactions were proven based on witness testimony. He served a brief stint in prison of about 3 months. April 25th. Amelia Dyer made her 4th appearance at Reading Police Court. Arthur also appeared. More damning testimonies and evidence were examined, like interactions with Amelia and eyewitness accounts given by Granny Smith, more contracts and receipts. April 30th, the final victim was found. PC Vince of the Berkshire Constabulary was walking along the towpath between the village of Sonning to the Dreadnought Public House. Adjacent to the mouth of the River Kennet, he saw a bundle in the weeds. It resided about 6 feet from the bank. Some linen protruded from within. The officer attached some string to a stick and dragged the package to shore. He took the package by boat to a police station. The parcel contained the body of a baby boy. The corpse was so severely decomposed that if the officer had not handled it with care, it would have defragmented. Dr. Maurice handled the examination. According to his findings, the child's head was wrapped in pink flannel. There was a handkerchief inside the flannel. The two ends of the flannel had been twisted into a ligature, crossed at the back of the head, and tied tightly under the chin. Dr. Maurice speculated that strangulation using this method may alone have been the cause of death. The rest of the baby's body was wrapped in white flannel. The boy's age was approximated at between 9 and 10 months. He was well nourished, though he had no hair and no teeth. There were no signs of foul play. The doctor opined that the child was submerged in the water between 3 and 4 months. A large hole poked in the linen was an indicator that a brick had likely been used to sink the corpse. A piece of tape was found on this child, and it was identified as being the same kind found on victims of Amelia Dyer. There was not enough evidence to definitively pronounce that the boy was strangled, however, so he was ruled to have been drowned. More witnesses came forward, like mothers of children who were taken to Amelia Dyer. After evaluating all the evidence and hearing all testimonies, the jury only needed a few minutes to deliver a verdict of willful murder against Amelia Dyer. Marianne Palmer was charged with being an accessory after the fact when her involvement was proven based on witness testimony. Amelia Dyer was taken in a cab to Reading Prison. As this was 1896, a cab consisted of a horse and carriage, so a crowd was able to keep pace with a cab, and they, quote, yelled and hooted to their heart's content, end quote. Marianne Palmer was also remanded to prison. May 22, 1896. Amelia Dyer appeared at the Old Bailey and pleaded guilty to one charge of murder, that being of Doris Marmon. Dyer tried for an insanity defense, and her previous stays in insane asylums would have proven to be an asset, but the prosecution argued successfully that this was just a ploy to avoid prosecution. It didn't help that she was committed to these institutions at times when she was paranoid that her crimes were about to be exposed. June 10, 1896. Amelia Elizabeth Dyer was hanged at Newgate Prison. On the scaffold, she was asked if she had anything to say. She only said, "I have nothing to say." Shortly thereafter, she was kicked off the platform. The exact number of children who died by Amelia Dyer's hand remains unknown. Speculation has it that her infanticidal killing spree could have resulted in a body count of as much as 50, but this has not been proven. Thank you for listening to Human Monsters. Bye for now.